You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. In the wake of a surprising result in the U.S. presidential election, questions continue to appear about Russian hacking into the emails of Democratic organizations and individuals during the campaign. In today's episode, Dissecting the DNC Hack, foreign policy and cybersecurity experts analyzed the attacks that happened over the summer. This discussion was convened by the Hewlett Foundation in September 2016. The panelists are Jeff Belknap, Chief Security Officer at Slack, Bruce McConnell, Global Vice President at the East-West Institute, Michael McFaul, the Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute, David Sanger, National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, and Amy Ziegert, Co-Director of the Center for International Security and Cooperation. The discussion follows.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you again for joining us today. I'm Eli Sugarman from the Hewlett Foundation, and very pleased to welcome you to Stanford University and to thank Stanford for graciously hosting this luncheon event. We have a great panel today to discuss a very timely set of issues. So timely, in fact, that we didn't fully appreciate that when we started planning this event in late June, after revelations about 20,000 internal DNC emails being leaked and that leak and breach hitting the front page of various newspapers and commanding the attention of policymakers worldwide. But since then, in July, obviously, there was news about the DCC also being breached. And then in August, the FBI, it became known, had alerted election officials in Arizona and Illinois that their voter registration databases had also been targeted. And just this week, we learned that U.S. Olympians' medical information had also been made public. Experts have attributed much of this activity to Russia and groups close to the Russian government. If that's true, what is Russia's intent? Are they trying to impact the upcoming presidential election, undermine one candidate, advantage another, or just really try to sow discord and perhaps embarrass the United States? Also, how should the U.S. government respond? What's the real national security response here, and what are the right issues to focus on? How do we think about this in terms of, is it theft, is it espionage, is it conflict? Really, the point I'm trying to make is that this situation that's evolving really captures a really interesting set of issues that really define what cybersecurity policymaking is. Our panel will really dive into these issues. And the reason we're organizing this panel is that the Hewlett Foundation, which is a large private philanthropy that was founded 50 years ago by Bill Hewlett, the co-founder of Hewlett-Packard and his wife, Flora, we have a cyber initiative, which is a grant-making effort to really develop a better discussion about these issues, to bring together business, civil society, government, to really chart a long-term strategy to think through how do you work through all of these challenging times. I guess the last point I'd make before introducing our panel is that the reason we really have launched this initiative is because we believe philanthropy has a role to play in addressing pressing cybersecurity challenges. And that is a novel viewpoint for some, but really the idea is that government has a role to play, the private sector has a role to play, academic institutions like Stanford have a role to play, but so too does philanthropy. And so it's really exciting to see several grantees in the audience from Stanford, from UC Berkeley, from elsewhere. Thank you again for your hard work. It's an honor to support you. So with that, let me give you a quick introduction to our panelists. I'm not going to belabor their professional accomplishments.
No, don't. Go ahead.
Okay. you know them. You know that they are experts, but a few words nonetheless. Jeff Belknap is Chief Information Security Officer at Slack, former Chief Security Officer at Palantir. His expertise protecting networks from advanced adversaries and attackers, I think, will really help us dive into and dissect what has happened with the DNC and other entities. Bruce McConnell is Senior Vice President at the East-West Institute, where he oversees a lot of their cybersecurity programming, and we're also lucky enough to support some of that. Previously, Bruce held a series of senior positions in the U.S. government, including as Deputy Undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security, responsible for cybersecurity, protecting civilian government agencies, critical infrastructure, and the like. Mike McFaul, who brings unique insight into Russia, its leadership, its you know, how it flexes its muscles in cyberspace as a former U.S. ambassador to Russia and senior director for Russian affairs at the National Security Council. Mike is also professor of political science here at Stanford, director of the Freeman Spogli Institute, which includes Encina Hall, where we find ourselves today, and also the Helen Bing Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute. You may have first read about the DNC hack from David Sanger, who's the national security correspondent for the New York Times. David is also a former Washington, D.C. bureau chief, member of two teams that won the Pulitzer Prize, the author of some of the most insightful both newspaper reporting, but then also books about cyber operations, Stuxnet, Olympic Games, and the like. And finally, we are very excited that Amy Ziegert will moderate today's discussion. Amy is co-director here of the Center for International Security and Cooperation, CSAC, as well as the Davies Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute. She's also a professor of political science. Amy is a noted expert on the U.S. national security community, the intelligence community, its history, as well as sort of really leading CSAC's efforts to research cybersecurity policy, to educate, and to engage in sort of outreach to experts like you all who are assembled today. Thank you again for coming, and please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel.
Well, thank you, Eli, for that lovely introduction. I just have to say, I had the best job. I get to moderate a panel with all these great experts here. And I also took a quick look at the name tags as we were walking in. I realized that all of you could be up here, too. So we're going to have a great conversation up here for a little bit. And we'll make sure to open it up for lots of time for Q&A from all the experts who are here with us today. So I want to thank you all for coming. I also want to just take a minute to thank Eli Sugarman and the Hewlett Foundation, not just for putting on today's event, but for really incredible thought leadership when it comes to cybersecurity. Really early leader, not just in the philanthropy side, but in bringing people together to think through how we can better address these challenges. So this is just one part of what they're doing. So thank you for your leadership in that. I just want to set the table briefly, and then I'm going to ask some questions of my colleagues up here. And I want to set the table with two questions for us all to noodle on as we delve into some different aspects of the DNC hack and other recent activities. Question number one, what's the vulnerability here? Cyber issues, as you all know well, are never just about technical issues. The political vulnerability here is equally important. And in two ways. First, we have an 8-member Supreme Court. So institutionally, were there to be an election crisis, we are less well equipped to deal with it today than we would have been a year ago, or 4 years ago, or 8 years ago. And secondly, we have this context of deep anxiety about where we are as a country today. A poll recently showed that more than half of all Americans feel less safe today than on 9/11, 15 years ago. That's extraordinary. We hear a lot of talk about the system being rigged in this election, and so the context is a psychological context of deep anxiety and distrust of our governmental institutions. So that's the what's the vulnerability piece I want to come back to. The second is, what constitutes interference in a democratic election? That's not so straightforward. Intelligence agencies are paid to gather intelligence on other countries, including their candidates running for president. That's what they're supposed to do, right? So what constitutes interference? What's the difference between penetrating a system to gather information, releasing that information, and then potentially tampering with the will of the voters on election day? So we'll get into that too. So what's the vulnerability? What does interference mean? Now I get these great people next to me to explain everything that we want to know. So I want to turn first to David Sanger, who, if you haven't read it already, has already written a piece this morning on Syria and is now covering cyber in the afternoon. So David, let's start with you. Fast-moving events. Eli referred to some of them with Guccifer 2.0 and the latest. Help us understand what are the most important things that we should know and what are the questions we don't know the answers to yet.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Eli, for having me here today. As for somebody who has to reside either mostly on the East Coast or on an airplane, mostly in recent days with the Secretary of State as he was doing the Syria stuff, coming out to Stanford is like, you know, if I didn't have to go back today, I might stay a while. Your two questions that you've put are just right. So I think there are a couple of frames in which we should think about this. The first is, it's not like the DNC hack came up out of nothing. The same intelligence agencies that we're concerned about here, the FSB and the GRU, wouldn't you love to see their files on Mike? That must be pretty good.
Why are you assuming I haven't seen them?
These are well-known groups in Washington. They're well-known at the State Department because they managed to get into and exfiltrate all of the State Department's unclassified emails. They were indexing State Department emails before the FBI even sort of began thinking about doing that. The GRU has been involved in many events involving American military contractors and so forth. The attacks on the White House unclassified system, the attacks on the JCS unclassified system. I say attacks, it's probably not really the right word, because most of this was just gathering of data. And as you point out, Amy, that's what foreign intelligence agencies do. And this is at the core of Washington's problem with this, because President Obama made a decision, either because of the nature of the attribution or the nature of the politics, not to call out the Russians on any of those previous hacks. The U.S. government never publicly accused the Russians, even though in every background briefing they would discuss it. The president's never talked about it in public. He said very little about cyber in public, other than sort of generic things about improving cybersecurity. So one way to think about this, and Mike and I were talking about this a little bit earlier today, is the question, did the United States government, by its concerns about naming the Russians, basically pave the way? And one reason to ask that question is because the Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, has frequently said, if it's mere intelligence gathering, it's not an attack. He doesn't want rules against that because it would stop what the United States does. Under the same logic, the U.S. government has never publicly charged the Chinese with the theft of the OPM data, the Office of Personnel Management, where the security files and security applications of about 21 million Americans, including their fingerprints and lots of personal details, debts, past marriages, so forth and so on, are all listed. So the Chinese have got an incredible database here, but the U.S. said that wasn't a cyber attack, it was cyber espionage. So the question you've asked, Amy, is, does it pass over that line when you then take that data and filter it back into the system? And that's what happened with the DNC hack. So the DNC was hacked starting in June of 2015. They were clueless about it, just like the Office of Personnel Management, just like so many others, for probably about 10 or 11 months, which is about the norm for these kinds of things. Then the GRU came in. They were a little bit more clunky in how they did this, stole this data. And then it started getting published by somebody who identified themselves as Guccifer II, who was widely believed to just be a name for basically a group created by the GRU. What happened was they published this stuff and no one paid attention. That's an awful thing in this modern media world when you go to all this trouble and you steal all this stuff, you publish it, and people are like, really? So they gave it to WikiLeaks thinking this would give it more attention, and it did. And this happened just before the Democratic National Convention. And you saw Debbie Wasserman Schultz resign, a lot of embarrassment. And then the question of whether or not they would hack into the vote itself. So to your second question, which is what constitutes interference? Does the mere spreading of information constitute interference? Well, maybe so, but if so, the history of the American intelligence agencies, as you know better than I, Amy, from Latin America to places in Eastern Europe and so forth, is full of what that would be considered interference. Could they mess with the vote? Well, we're getting ready to publish a story on this, and I would say that the consensus of the intelligence people we have spoken to and some testimony from Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA yesterday in the Senate, suggests probably our system is so clunky, spread across 50 different states, every one of which does this a little bit differently with paper backup and so forth, that while you could affect the votes, sooner or later it would get sorted out in an audit. But it might make the hanging chads 2000 election look like sort of analog child's play, right? The second thing they could do is sow just enough doubt in five or six key swing states that people would say, gee, if you've messed with those five or six, how do I know that my vote in my state, even if that state wasn't affected? As you say, this is as much about psychology and politics as it is about technology. A last point on this. If their goal was merely not to change the election, but simply to disturb it, then they've already sort of accomplished a good part of their strategic goals. Because Donald Trump has said that on many occasions that he believes the system is rigged, you can imagine that he could be setting the predicate if he doesn't win. But it's actually the Clinton campaign that seems to be much more concerned about what could happen here. A final point, this intersects, this is more Mike's territory than mine, this intersects with Trump's own interesting views about Russia. It was not only his invitation to the Russians to go hack into the system, but it's extremely difficult to get him to discuss what he might do to deter Russia from a range of activities around the world, not just cyber activities, but others. I've done two lengthy foreign policy interviews with Mr. Trump now, one in March with my colleague Maggie Haberman, then we went back again the day before his acceptance speech in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. So I spent about three and a half hours with him. And over that time, he's talked a lot about deterring China. He's talked a lot about forcing NATO to contribute more. He's talked a lot about letting South Korea and Japan get their own nuclear weapons if they don't pay more for their own defense. But I had a very difficult time getting him to talk in strategic terms about changing Russian behavior.
So that tees up our exploration of what in the world is Putin thinking, Mike, as we think about, I mean, that's the big question, right? What are the motives? And is this a strategic endeavor? And if Putin is behind this, and that's a big if he's behind it, what are the motives, domestic versus international? Help us understand. You know him better than anybody here.
I don't know about that. Well, well, first of all, thanks for doing this. Thanks, Eli. This is a great, like you said, a lot more news has been written since that you had the idea to do this. It's great to partner with you all. It's great to have your tablecloths, too. This is an upgrade from our normal FSI events, by the way. Or maybe somebody else did that. I don't know if that was Hewlett or my own team. A couple of things. I just want to be, I want to dwell a little bit on the means, because I don't have much to say about that. But I want to make sure we underscore what David just said, which is that in my view, and most of my views, I can't talk about, and I'm not going to talk about, because, Secretary Clinton has been interrogated on this rightly, I'll just remind you, as a former government official, I see some other former government officials here now, I've been out for a couple of years. In my head, I have unclassified, SBU, confidential, secret, top secret, and compartmentalized information in my head. And there's only one that I'm supposed to talk about, and the other ones get me in trouble. And so I just say that as a caveat to forgive me to not say things I would like to say. But you all should know, because of good reporting, but you actually, I don't think, have seen what nearly I've seen, is that Russia has tremendous capability to do all of these things that you were alluding to and way, way more. When I get into an argument sometimes on TV and say, well, we have no proof that the Russians hacked the DNC, I look at that in just the same spirit of intelligence gathering as fundamentally naive. Like, if they're not hacking the DNC, they're not doing their jobs. And my 5 years in government dealing with the Russians, first in Washington and then in Moscow, is that they do their jobs and they do them extremely well, okay? There's a reason we have you put your cell phones in little packets and on the boxes before you come to see us at the NSC. There's a reason that when we even talk about, let me get this right, even confidential, and now I may even be revealing something I shouldn't. Let me be more abstract. Anytime you deal with anything that is above SBU in the US government and Moscow, if you've ever watched the movie Get Smart, and you see the doors that they go through and the wheels and the different codes they have to do, that's what you need to do to look at that data. And that there's a reason we do that, because they have these kinds of capabilities, okay? So to me, the capabilities discussion is not interesting. And I would say the exact same thing about us. We're probably better, but that's our job, right? That's not interesting at all. What is interesting to me is that it was discovered. That's worth more attention from our colleagues that know all that, right? Are we getting better at this? It was a private company that finally got involved. That's interesting to me. The information was gathered is not interesting at all. And will the public, over time, as those capabilities become better, teach us all about the true capacities of the Russians and the Chinese? Because I think we most people here don't know. Not this room. This room's weird. But most Americans don't. It's just, you don't think about, like, having a phone in your pocket is a communication device to the KGB. Most people don't think about that. I just briefed a group of members of Congress staffers, Amy, I think you did too, and I asked them how many use WhatsApp. They all just, no disrespect, they use Gmail. Gmail. Sorry. They use Gmail. Oh, no big deal. Oh, and you're talking about sensitive things. Oh, yeah. What about Telegram? Oh, no, we don't do that. One, I would say 10% even knew what I was talking about, let alone had thought about using those alternative ways to communicate. So that piece is obvious. The second piece that is obvious, in my opinion, on the means and motivations part, this gets to the motivations, is that WikiLeaks, of course, dumped data into our system to influence and intervene or interfere in our electoral process. Mr. Assange has said that himself. There's no mystery to that at all. And I would just remind everybody that WikiLeaks is a foreign organization. It's not an American organization. And we were just talking about it over lunch. We have laws. We don't use them very often. FARA, if you remember FARA, that goes back to the days pre-World War II, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. When there was a time when we were concerned about these kinds of things, we've kind of not thought about that so much. So should WikiLeaks have to register as FARA, or do we just treat them as part of David's profession? But there should be no question, in my view, that WikiLeaks deliberately and successfully dumped that data to have an impact on our democratic process. The part that, of course, I can't say for certain, but I most certainly hope our friends in the government could say for certain behind those locked doors I was talking about, is did WikiLeaks receive the information from the GRU or the SVR? My prediction is that we're not going to know that for a long time for two reasons. One, WikiLeaks has ways to obtain information without knowing where it came from. But more importantly, because these people are very professional, they have ways of transferring that data without you knowing that it was them. Bortnikov just doesn't call up Julian and say, hey, Bortnikov's the head of the FSB. Hey, I got some great data, tell me where I can send it. They obviously work through intermediaries, and I would just say, and I'm going to stop on this part, that they are very, very good at doing that. One troubling piece that I can't say in this particular case, because I don't know it well, but you should all be aware of, that sometimes data is shipped that is modified, very cleverly modified. And then without fingerprints. What do we do with that? We all assume when we see a data dump that we know that it came from in this case, the DNC. I can't say because I don't know the specifics on this, but I do know other instances where we thought it was hacked data that, in fact, on the way through the intermediaries and maybe at the source was modified. And that gets me to the election piece, which I think we should worry about a lot. On motivations, let me just be brief. One other thing. The Russians in other elections and for other political outcomes have boldly and unapologetically used SIGINT to have a political effect inside other countries. They don't have any qualms about it. So let me give you two examples. And I actually myself have been a target of this. So I briefed a U.S.-Russia Business Council meeting in the Marriott Hotel in downtown Moscow one time as ambassador. And 3 days later, a modified version of what I said appeared on the Russian, on a website. It was obviously recorded. The Marriott Hotel, if you're staying there, beware. Or any other hotel in Russia, for that matter. I don't mean to single out the Marriott company. And then, the way it was spliced made it sound like I had said something very different than what I'd said. My colleague, Toria Nuland, more famously, was in a conversation that was intercepted and then broadcast. She said some other things. I don't use those kind of words myself. But
that's how we knew it was genuine.
That's how we knew it was genuine. Right. And that was done for a very specific reason to influence an outcome in Ukraine. And by the way, in a distorted way, if we want to go back to that story, it wasn't that she was trying to put together a government that we wanted. She was trying to do a deal between Yanukovych, the sitting president, and the prime minister. And then just third, any Russian government official or opposition figure will tell you they don't talk to anybody with their phones around because literally hundreds of them have been the targets of this kind of operation where things are intercepted, emails intercepted, and used for political purposes inside Russia. So that's on the mean side. On the motivation side, this is a little trickier to me because there's no question in my mind that Putin would prefer Donald Trump to be president over Clinton. There's just no question. For two reasons. One, Mr. Trump says a lot of things, including in his interview with you, David, that are policies that Mr. Putin supports. You don't need a PhD in Russian studies to think that that's a good thing, therefore, for Mr. Putin, right? When Mr. Trump says, I would look into recognizing Crimea as part of Russia, And the other candidate doesn't say that, it's very rational for him to prefer Mr. Trump. When Mr. Trump says the things that he says about our NATO allies that scare them to death, especially those that are closest to Russia, that's exactly what Mr. Putin would want. And the converse, I don't want to go through the whole list, but the converse is also true, I just want to underscore. The things that Secretary Clinton says in terms of what she will do in terms of Russian policy and what she did before does not make her popular in the Kremlin as well. And in particular, I just want to remind you of one piece because it links up to the symmetry of activity here. When I was in the government, the Russians held a parlementary election in December 2011, and Secretary Clinton, and for those of you who follow government statements, as people like David do, you know the difference between the press spokesperson saying it, or the NSC press spokesperson, or the Secretary of State, or the President saying it, right? There's a difference. And she, in her voice, basically said the election in December 2011 was not free and fair and needs to be investigated. And Putin went crazy. He was very upset, both in public and in private. And in public said, Clinton has sent a signal to the demonstrators to come out and protest against this election. In other words, blaming her for delegitimating that electoral process inside Russia, just to get back to your second question. And I have heard him many times speak about that and other activities that he is assigned to the Obama administration, but to her in particular. There's no doubt in my mind that he is upset about that, and he's a guy that likes to take revenge. I can talk about other cases, including Crimea, where when he feels he's been double-crossed, he looks for an opportunity to act. Now, the last thing I want to say, though, having the means and having the motive does not mean you actually do those things. And I think that's something we need to be careful about, right? Is it good for him that Trump wins? Well, yes. Therefore, these other things that he may have the means to do does not in and of itself mean that he will do those things. And the caveat I would put to it right now is, with respect to the election, is I'm not an expert on American elections, but I am nervous about the asymmetric reaction to 10 or 12 people having to do a provisional ballot because somehow their name got hacked off of the list, right? That is a nightmare scenario, especially in my district here in Palo Alto, when their votes don't matter for the electoral presidential election anyway. But that will outrage my neighbors, that will create that's for people who are more expert about America than I am. But I worry about, because a minor incident can have a big impact, especially because Trump has already set the predicate. That doesn't mean, however, that the Russians will be the ones to do it. Because, and then I'll defer to other experts, I would just say, from my time in government, the Russians have tremendous capability. But man, so do a lot of other people, including kids at gun high school. And so to jump to, because the registration here on Stanford campus got hacked, that it was Putin, I just would remind everybody there are thousands of other actors that can do these kinds of things.
So you've teed up, Mike, a great question for these experts over here, which is, are we getting better? Right. So, Jeff, I want you to tackle this first. You've seen the challenges in the private sector. You understand challenges in the public sector. Compare the sort of challenges across organizations and the ability of the private sector versus government, whether it's federal or, in this case, in the election, state and local organizations to defend themselves. And then, Bruce, I want to turn it to you, since I know you've had a career in including government service at DHS, about how are we doing? Are we getting better? Jeff, why don't you go first?
Sure. So thanks, first of all, Eli, for having me here. Usually, for me to be on a panel with this kind of gravitas, several people have had to cancel for me to get a seat up here. So I'm flattered to be up here, as I presume a first choice. I'll just tell myself that. I think ultimately, the first thing I want to point out is, for practitioners, and I can consider myself a practitioner. I'm somebody who has the responsibility to put down policy and then execute on that policy individually in a commercial entity. Attribution really doesn't matter. It's irrelevant, right? So what actually matters is, are we getting better? Do we know, do we have a baseline? Do we understand where we're at currently, and are we consistently making improvements on that? And then, do we have the ability to gather, either through knowing ourselves pretty well and knowing our systems pretty well, do we have the ability to gather any indication about do we need to accelerate or prioritize different areas, right? So I think when I look at this specifically, I have have a variety of opinions on the policy side and sort of what it means. But for me as a practitioner, this is all sort of just a distraction or a way stop on the path of, like, hey, this stuff actually matters, and we actually need to have an appropriate impact on this in our organizations. So if I look at how we get stuff done in the commercial sector versus how some of my peers in the public sector get things done, the main thing that I see as a challenge is the flexibility that I have as a commercial entity is far better and ultimately leads to far better outcomes when I'm looking at sort of de-risking an environment that I'm responsible for, or making sure that I can roughly sleep at night. My ability to do that is far and away better, and I'll say it's far and away better almost explicitly because I have more or less final say over my budget and my budgeting process, right? So at the federal level, especially, it's pretty easy to attack because kind of budgeting all goes through one branch of government. And the ability for a federal agency, especially a federal civilian agency, to go identify gaps and identify improvements and then execute on those improvements in a very agile and a very quick way is severely hampered by sort of the budgeting process and how capital budgets get issued, how long you have to live with the system in which you have to get things done, and what people you have to use, things like that. So ultimately, for me, it comes down to if there was one thing, if I had one wish to grant, it would be that we would suddenly come to our senses as a governance, as a governed body, and give people the ability to make appropriate changes, you know, in a way that made sense. And I look at as a good example of that is organizations like 18F and USDF and USDS and some things that GSA is doing. I think those are great prototypes for how we solve problems in the commercial sector. We look at, you know, what do we have? Where do we want to get to? What's the debt we need to blow through in terms of technical debt? And, you know, how do we make immediate progress? That is just not a thing that we, in certain branches of the government, we as a country can't get past that yet, right? And I think that's probably the biggest hurdle that we have. On the commercial side, it's very easy for me to make a judgment and go, you know, there's a major issue here and we need to address it either through improving identification, authentication, add multiple factors of authentication, add different sets of telemetry, add people, process, and policies and metrics to sort of make sure that all of those things are having a positive impact on the outcomes that I want to deliver. I have the ability to do all that. And I have the luxury of being in a place where I have great, brilliant people. I have people that are willing to think outside the box and take risks. And I have the ability to be held accountable by my leadership and my boards to encourage those risks, right? And to reward those risks and to sort of push that needle further. And I think there's a lot of great organizations that do. But, you know, again, I think if I look at when I was briefly in state and local government at the beginning of my career, I couldn't send a fax effectively, right? And I had to, the process by which I had to use to communicate with other departments was so esoteric, it sort of drove me out of state and local government. So I think that's a thing that for me, I always come back to, like, this is a great discussion. I have lots of opinions and thoughts about what we should do and how the intelligence community might think about this. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to security is a process, and the more effective you can be at executing that process and continually improving that process, the more you can reduce risk in any system. And I think, so I just want to come back to what you said. I think the word I'd use instead of clunky is robust. Our election system is robust. But I think, you know, ultimately, we might be at this point in critical infrastructure falling back on the fact that we're so robust in the ancient systems we might be using that, you know, that might be the only thing protecting us, or at least that's what I worry about sometimes, being the only thing protecting us in some critical areas.
Bruce, you're on the front lines of this. Your view on where we are, and are we robust? Are we clunky? How vulnerable are we?
That's great. So if you know, the last time I went to vote, I live in Oakland, and I voted. I went and voted in a garage, somebody's house. That's where the polling place was. And so all of you have, from various parts of the country have seen that the infrastructure that that runs our voting system is not, shall we say, the top of the line infrastructure. And this is, why is this? Well, it's mainly a thing about budgets, because those parts of state governments and counties and election boards and stuff are not highly financed. Elections are expensive. They don't happen all the time. So the investments haven't been made. There's no awareness there. But even if that was the case, and the election systems that we have, the automated portions of them, investments have been made, you have to figure that, well, if JP Morgan Chase can't secure themselves, then it's pretty unlikely that a state and local government's going to be able to really secure itself against a well-funded, capable, persistent state actor like the one we've been discussing here, or somebody else. So there's a lot of people who have that capability. So if you're talking about the cyber vulnerabilities of the systems, the election systems, where it is connected to the internet in particular, then there's plenty of vulnerabilities, and not only the high school students at Gunn, but certainly the well-motivated state actors could get in if they wanted to do that. and a lot of things they could do about that. And so one of the things that's happened because of these cost pressures, of course, is that these state and local governments have been told by the people who make voting machines that, hey, listen, you can save a lot of money by automating this stuff. And when the question, when the rare time comes up, maybe more increasing now, that an official says, well, is it secure? The answer is yes, it is. Trust me. So, of course, everyone in this room knows that no technology that we use is actually secure. It's all got vulnerabilities in it. And so I'll come back to that in a minute. But there has been a driver to automate this, partly because of cost, partly because of accessibility for disabled people, partly to get the votes of overseas military to come in. So there's advantages and to automating parts of this, but it's being done in a kind of haphazard way. And that gets to the clunky or robust story, because in fact it's very uneven. So there are places that don't have paper backup anymore. There are places who the whole system is connected somewhat to the internet in ways that is probably that you or I would say, wait a minute, you're taking on more risk than you need to take on. Is there ways you can deal with that? So there's a lot of variety in the map, and so in terms of what do you do to address this? Because there's nothing, we can't make major investments and change out the system between now and November, right? So, but in the short term, the kinds of advice that DHS now is starting to give out and others include things like, well, you should minimize the connections to the internet of the systems that are involved in vote processing, vote collection, anything like that. You should have paper backup if you should be ready to do that, so that, as David says, or you guys were saying, that at the end of the day we'll get to the answer. None of us want to go through the hanging chads again, but we may need to. Third, to watch for anomalies. So what about some precinct that never votes this way, but all of a sudden voted some different way? So that requires data analysis capabilities in the election boards and stuff, not always present. But maybe there's ways of reconstructing and looking at things if there's some really unexpected result someplace, which would require, to hide those kinds of things requires a more sophisticated kind of attack than a brute force one. And finally, the fourth thing, vendor transparency. So, the vendors should get independent security audits and publish results of those, or they should expose their code to experts to look at those kinds of things. There's none of that going on. So, one of the ways that this could happen would be, in part anyway, for DHS to designate this as critical infrastructure. It's not designated as critical infrastructure today, and that's for a couple of reasons. It's kind of interesting, actually, but long tradition and the Constitution, the 10th Amendment, and political concerns have kept the feds out of elections. And when Secretary Johnson recently of DHS recently said that they were considering this, naming it as critical infrastructure, the Georgia Secretary of State said, this is just a conspiracy to federalize the elections, that Washington's going to take over the elections using the security as a stalking horse, as an excuse. So the feds have been very reluctant, and certainly when I served in the, under Secretary Napolitano, it was, important to kind of keep an arm's length from the election system at the federal level because of these kind of constitutional and political concerns, that there's concern about trying to influence outcomes from the federal government. But the DHS is considering now designating it as a critical infrastructure, which would allow DHS to provide technical assistance and provide some guidelines and whatnot. It's not a regulatory thing. It doesn't give them any regulatory authority. But there's another little understood implication of that designation, which is interesting. So as we talked about earlier, it's unknown where a cyber intrusion becomes an attack. This is a matter that is being debated by international lawyers at the UN. One of the things these international lawyers and foreign policymakers have come up with is an emerging set of norms of behavior about what people, what countries should do with each other during peacetime. And one of the emerging norms is you should not attack the other country's critical infrastructure during peacetime, and you should be responsible for attacks coming from your country. So if DHS were to designate this as critical infrastructure, it would allow, as a diplomatic talking point, if you wanted to make the attribution, you could say, wait a minute, you Russians agreed to this norm in the UN group of experts. It's not a treaty or anything. But, you know, what about this? So it makes an interesting interesting point. So I think that's the main thing I would say. The last thing is that just on this point about Clinton's views of this thing and kind of what has the U.S. done, which makes it difficult. Both what do we do that makes it difficult for us to ask others not to do things that we like to do, but also what have we done in this area? You know, we have also done things like this in cyberspace in the following way. We have promoted encryption technology and other technologies that make people like the Russians and Chinese very nervous, and they tell, whenever I'm speaking with them, they say, you guys are just trying to promote color revolutions in our country. This is bad for domestic peace and tranquility and political stability, so you really don't have a clean hand. So I think from a kind of ideological point of view, we're not completely clean and have a more difficult time of taking the high ground from a moral standpoint. So when we get back to what's the response of this diplomatically and otherwise, it gets even trickier. Thanks.
Amy, one just quick point Mr. McConnell said, if I was an FSB officer and I was trying to figure out where to go on vacation in the United States come the fall, lovely as it would be to come to California and hang out in the garage in Oakland, I think I'd go to Pennsylvania because it's the biggest swing state that has no paper backup. And you'll read a little bit about this tomorrow in the Times, but there are only two or three states right now, I think, that don't have paper backup. And
15.
I'm sorry? 15 that have none?
Either five that have none and 10 others that have partial.
Partial.
Including Virginia and Florida,
right.
Too.
But Pennsylvania's got none statewide, as I understand it.
Five states.
Got none statewide.
Georgia's one of them.
So more places for FSB to vacation.
That's it.
More places for you to travel to.
So while we're on the what is really going to depress you and keep you up at night part of the conversation, let me ask each of you to weigh in before we open up to everybody else. If there are surprises between now and Election Day, or if you're a devious FSB person going to Pennsylvania or Georgia or any of these other states, what would you do? What are you most worried about happening between now and Election Day? Mike, you referred to the fact that right now we assume that the data dumps are accurate information, but the intelligence community is worried about altering the integrity of data, right? So in your devious minds of the adversary, what would you do that would worry us as Americans in the next couple months?
Well, my worry is not about Election Day. My worry is about the next data dump from WikiLeaks that will have even more damning information about one of the candidates. And I fully expect that to happen. And I think it's going to be a huge crisis. I think we should, I don't know what to do about it, but it's going to be big. They're going to, you know, I have some friends that, you know, she used to be my boss. We're on the record, aren't we? Never mind. I don't have any friends. I just think that is coming. I just cannot believe that what we've seen so far is all they have. Having participated in an election in 2008 in a much more intimate way, and that is going to come well before this Election Day scenario we're talking about, and it's going to be a huge. That's my nightmare scenario. How do we react to that? I don't want to go.
They've already seen that in the Colin Powell emails that got leaked overnight, although it's not clear who was behind the leak there, and it's not clear that that would have necessarily helped Donald Trump. He had some pretty unpleasant things to say about Donald Trump and some issues with Secretary Clinton for, in his words, dragging him into the email controversy.
Do you believe that the Russians don't have the capability to obtain?
I didn't say that. I'm just saying that
But that's the point. No, no, but this is the attribution thing. Like, you don't care about attribution, I understand that. But from a political point of view, that data about one candidate is being released and not another one that we all know has an impact. If you care about the integrity of our elections, these are foreign actors. And by the way, let's go back and talk about the color revolutions. I know a lot about them. That troubles me as an American voter, not as a partisan person. But why should the KGB have that influence on our election?
So let me.
I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying that you're placing the blame on the leaker. These things happened.
The leaker doesn't. I've had this argument with WikiLeaks director.
So let me see if I can just rephrase this for a second, and if you permit me to do that. So on the one hand, there's the, we need to be really worried about any foreign entity that is selectively releasing information about one candidate as opposed to another. That is corrupting our democratic process. On the other hand, there is the argument to be made that had there been no embarrassing emails in the DNC, had there been no conversation that in the light of day, had it made the front page of the New York Times, would be embarrassing, this would so far be a non-issue.
Correct, of course.
I think that's the issue.
I've had this debate with WikiLeaks personally, just so you know, you seem to think that they have no responsibility in this, and I just strongly disagree with that. I think that if they selectively release data, by the way, they've never released any data about any Russian official either, but if they selectively release data, that's a partisan statement. That's not a neutral position. And by the way, if you want to not be neutral, that's fine, but that's not the claim that they make publicly to all of us, that we're just releasing data that the American people have the right to know. Actually, they're making in my view, I want to emphasize that, they're making editorial decisions about how to use, in my view, I want to emphasize that too, stolen information. I think that affects the integrity of our election.
So I'm sensing people want to jump in from the audience with questions.
Already did.
So hang on one second, because my nightmare scenario is having everybody go crazy. But before we get to my nightmare scenario, I just want to give you guys a chance if you want to put your nightmare scenario about elections and hacking on the table. If not, we'll just go to the audience for questions.
I think we talked about this earlier. Ultimately, I do care about attribution as an American. I think just... It doesn't, it's a hot button issue for me because we talk about it a lot in the security industry, and I just beat my head against the wall and I was like, it does not matter in terms of somebody in my role or anybody that works on teams that I work with, like it doesn't matter, it doesn't impact what we do. As an American, I care very deeply, and I think it has a deep impact on public policy. I think my nightmare scenario here was I was at another dinner where we had there might have been some wine involved, but we were having a conversation about what could happen here, and I think I can't claim credit for this. Someone else said it, and I won't attribute who. But I think the most likely outcome here is that sometime between now and Inauguration Day, probably post election, someone will come out and say, "I tipped the election in the favor of whatever candidate won." And I think they're, at this point, if I take my practitioner hat off and take my American citizen hat and put that back on, I go, regardless of who is doing it and who is involved, there's clearly a pattern here of someone establishing that they have the credibility, capability, and ability to execute some sort of grand, potentially grand scheme.
That's a great point.
And they can come out later and say, "I tampered with that election." So if we end up in a position where we are Florida hanging chads, and somebody adds to that as a foreign power or a surrogate for a foreign power, "I tampered with this," I don't know how our country deals with that. And for me, that's a bit of a nightmare scenario.
I guess I agree with Mike that I'm worried more about the impact on the electorate of false information coming out. I mean, we worry about information being stolen, but James Clapper in his last intelligence assessment highlighted that concern as the biggest threat from a cyber standpoint. You can just think about this: if the Dow Jones average was coming out not reliable, or many other kinds of things like that, it's like this crisis of confidence. This creates a crisis There's a crisis of confidence in the election system, but I think this, when you start to get this misinformation out there, it's very, very difficult to correct the record after the fact, because it's you know, it will be exciting and spectacular information that will hard to be put back in the bottle.
Okay, please, if you have a question, raise your hand. Microphones are going around the room, and I'll try to, I have my glasses on so I can even see in the back. So yes, sir, right there.
You framed the discussion around a distinction between passive intelligence gathering and then feeding the information back into the system to influence an outcome, and also proposed that there might be a large leak of information before the election to destabilize the election. What about a third possibility, that the existence of that information could be used for blackmail? I raised this with someone in the IC a few weeks ago whose response was, no, that's much too long a game for the Russians. They don't play things out that way. But I'd be interested in your view of that. Mightn't it be better just to own the president instead of embarrass someone who you might be able to defeat?
You know, I have very strong views on that, and they're mostly ones I don't want to say on the record. I would just say that the technique of gathering embarrassing information about American officials, public and private, is one that the Russians practice, and they practice it for a long time. If you've watched any movies about the Cold War, and they continue to practice that. And I mean that about actual behavior and virtual behavior. And that's all I'm going to say.
I'd like to get back to a discussion of threats to the election. And I was the person who hollered out 15 before, sorry about that. But there are, in fact, 15 states where some of the voters will be voting on paperless machines. Of those 15, five are entirely paperless. The comment that the election will be sorted out by an audit doesn't make any sense, because you cannot audit where there's no paper. And furthermore, some states have laws that make it very difficult to conduct a post-election audit or recount. So we have, I just think that that's belittling the problem to make that comment, which I realize was not made by you, it was made by somebody else, but you're just repeating it. Also, some 32 states allow voters to vote over the internet. In most cases, it's only military voters overseas, and that's typically a small number of voters. But that is also insecure and cannot be audited, and of course, is subject to cyber attacks, as we all know. Another area which you haven't really touched on, and maybe this wasn't part of the plan, is the voter registration databases, aside from the 12 in Palo Alto. 12 in Palo Alto is no big deal, but if somebody were to go to one of the swing states and see who it belongs to a particular political party, because that's in the databases, you can disenfranchise large numbers of voters by delisting them or changing their addresses. This will be found out, this will be caught, but it would result in chaos at the polls, and it could cause a lot of people not to vote and could change the outcome of the election. So these databases, many of them are insecure. We know that two have already been broken into. There are no national standards for the databases. There's no oversight. There's no federal oversight. I think that the federal government's trying to help, but Georgia, you know, said, we don't need your help, even though they are clearly one of the most vulnerable states because they're entirely paperless. They don't vote on the old Diebold touchscreen voting machines, which we know how to hack.
David.
Sure. All excellent points, and these have come up in this interesting testimony that James Comey, the director of the FBI, gave last week on this. So because it's a presidential election, and because we're using the Electoral College system, which at various moments we all curse for the fact that it does not necessarily reflect the overall views of the Americans, in this case, it's a little bit of a protection, because of those five states where, as you say, there's no paper backup, you would only worry about those votes if it turns out that there are enough electoral votes in each one of those states to have actually swung the outcome. Now, psychologically, I think the effect would be quite big, because people would say, if you can't get in, you know, if you're able to do it here in 2016, imagine how good they'll be by 2020. It may also be the wake-up call. It's one of the reasons that I said what I said about Pennsylvania. And Virginia as well. So Pennsylvania has got the largest number of electoral votes in a place that we think is a true swing state right now, and no paper backup whatsoever. I'm sorry?
There's some.
So that's one of the big concerns, but it's not across the board. And if we had a true national election where we were just adding up the votes countrywide, we'd actually be in a lot worse shape.
We're robust.
But robust. Now, by the way, clunky was Comey's line. I thought it was a pretty good description. I mean, if you have some places that you're going into that do have paper backup, others you go into that don't, some of that are garage and some of that are, you know, at something presumably a little more high tech, it's a crazy system.
Eric.
We've talked some about the motivations and capabilities of the Russians, and that's been interesting insight. I'd like to ask about the capabilities and motivations of the DNC, you know, the defenders in this case. So we heard that there are some government groups, say, handling classified material that operate at a high level of gameplay to try to keep Russians out. There are some private groups that are also operating at that level, but then there are a lot of smaller private groups don't even think they would be a target because they've never had those classified briefings about capabilities. And then there are government organizations that maybe know, but because of congressional budgets can't do anything about it. How about the DNC? That seems to be an interesting intermediate case where I would have expected senior staffers there have friends who've had those briefings, so they know what they're up against. And yet, perhaps, I mean, they do have some money coming in, right? So what's in their mind in making those risk decisions? Do they think they're not a target? Well, no, they surely know better. Do they think it doesn't matter? Do they think we would deter the adversary or what? What? So any insight any of you can have who may know those folks better than I would?
I'll give you a little. Look, if they were in looking for policy being made by Hillary Clinton, the DNC isn't probably the first place I would go look. If they were looking for policy being made by Donald Trump, I certainly wouldn't look at the RNC. Okay. That's number one. Number two, it's very possible that they went in not knowing what they would find and then got what they got, which was basically a lot of snarky emails about Bernie Sanders, right? And so the news that came out was not exactly a great shock to anybody who had been, you know, following this stuff with some care, that the DNC preferred Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. And this by itself is not likely to be breaking news, yeah. But the way that it was worded was embarrassing and caused basically disruption. And it's possible that they may have just looked at this data and said, there's nothing of utility here from an intelligence viewpoint, but you could use it to make some mischief. And in the end, that's sort of what happened.
I can just comment a little bit on Eric's question, which is that, so, you know, we think about these campaign organizations as these, and the DNC, which is a standing organization, as these big things full of high-powered people who should know better. But in fact, they're really run on the shoestring. They're you know, it's only a few people's day job. And so, you know, trying to pull things together and just make the systems work is a challenge. So these are not, you know, in the rankings of, you know, of organizations like, you know, highly capable government organizations or the financial services sector and, you know, my server at home. They're, you know, I don't think they're as far down as that, but, you know, they're closer to that than they are the J.P. Morgan.
I think at the end of the day, and you know this as well as I do, people are the most challenging part of any system where you're trying to introduce some security or reduce some risk, right? So if it's not your full-time job, and if you have this cultural mindset of what you're doing is really not that interesting to somebody else, certainly not as interesting as credit card numbers or state secrets, it's very hard to change perceptions and change behaviors and get out the behaviors you want. Which is, if you look at just like you mentioned, the things you do to go into a vault are all about pomp and circumstance, and they are technically very valuable to do to dissuade people from successfully collecting SIGINT on you. But they're also to remind you as a person that's going into a space to have a sensitive conversation, that you're going into a space to have a sensitive conversation. And it's just as much about imbuing change in your behaviors as it is about technically defeating an adversary.
Could I just add to that I do believe that I know some folks, not at the DNC, but that work very closely with them, and they did not expect it. So the awareness thing, I think this is a really odd, strange gathering of people, right? Most people don't think any of it is, and they were shocked at what happened, and it's reverberated through the rest of the Democratic establishment, because it didn't stop with the DNC, right? And so they're now, I talk to people because of my background all the time, including some local politicians, by the way, about what should I be doing, what is different, what should I be doing differently. But I got to tell you, just to follow up on your question, I get unclassified emails all the time from US government officials. All the time. I bet you everybody does. I got three this morning. State.gov, you guys are the experts, but I've been trained to believe state.gov is not very protected, especially with interfacing with other email systems, including even Gmail, dare I say. And yet that is really bizarre to me. How much, you guys are the experts, but I worked in the government when we sent these unclassified emails all the time. There's no new protection, to the best of my knowledge, in the last several years. Have we upgraded that?
They did a bit after the Russians got in the last time. But this is an inherent problem with state.gov, which is, it turns out the State Department deals with a lot of foreigners. Who knew? and as a result,
we've got to stop that. You know,
there are some candidates who are suggesting. you're in an environment where you've got to communicate with, so most of the communications that are done back and forth with, say, the Russians over the Syria deal can't be by nature classified, because the Russians at the other end don't have U.S. security clearances.
Right.
And then worse yet, they have to communicate with reporters.
Right.
You can imagine what that's like.
Yes.
So it's a system that is designed to be outward facing, and as a result, there's going to be sensitive stuff in it.
But David, campaigns are not designed to be communicating with foreigners. I want to get back to Eric's question, right? Which is, it shouldn't have been a surprise to the DNC, right? Yeah. I mean, Obama and McCain's campaign websites were hacked, presumably attributed to the Chinese government in 2008. It was well known then. There were intelligence briefings. It was reported in the press. This is a surprise that shouldn't have been a surprise. So from a policy perspective, you're talking about presidential campaigns, forget the DNC for a minute, the RNC, presidential candidates should have some more protection, some more awareness training, some baseline of capability before, at the early part of the process. Imagine if this had happened during the primary season too, right? We're just talking about the general election with sowing.
It did happen during the primary season. I mean, they were into the DNC system.
But injecting, then releasing, hack and release part of it, right?
Yeah.
So policy suggestions about what campaigns should they be required to have a baseline level of capability if you announce a run for president?
Right, Federal Election Regulatory Commission, right? They could present require that. I mean, it would be really a reach to require that, from a standpoint of policy. Nobody has the authority to do that.
I feel like you don't have to require it, right? I think my company nor Eric's are required to provide any level of security at all, really, above a basic duty to care. But I feel like the
but
same argument.
But you'll lose your customers if
you
don't.
So this is what I was going to say. The same argument I have with companies that, presumably don't do a sufficient job protecting their customers' data, is if you want to make an impact and you want to be the custodian of whatever data or the custodian of public policy and hold an ultimate office, maybe you should show me as an American voter that you care about these things and that you take them seriously. I think there are some candidates that have made their entire campaign on saying, I don't really take anything seriously, and You know, the fact that that works is also a problem.
Well, but to your larger point, I think you're right. I mean, this is a whole problem of awareness in general. You know, we always say there's two kinds of companies, those that have been hacked and those that know they've been hacked. So once they've been hacked, they get religion and make some investments. But the other piece of this is that you can't stay out in front. Nobody can stay out in front unless they're willing. Nobody can afford to stay out in front of a concerted state attacker. So you have to deal with that diplomatically and through other means. And you know, you may get to the point where you know, maybe we don't require companies to put anti-missile launchers on the top of their factories and pay for them themselves, right? But we require everybody to defend themselves against against state attackers. So I don't. When I was in the government, Keith Alexander always used to say that he'd be happy to patrol our networks for us, and nobody wants that. But there's some role for somebody beyond the individual company or political organization to defending themselves. Partly is to create disincentives in an international system. But anyway.
Hi, I have two questions. The first is, we spent a lot of time on Russia, but presumably Russia isn't the only government that has some kind of interest in the outcome of this election. And the way Mike talked about it, Russia sounded very logical. You mess with my election, I'll mess with yours. You mess with my athletes, I'll mess with yours. But there are states out there that aren't that logical. They don't play in big state politics in the same way. So if you had a hit list, the top five other than Russia, who might want to mess with this election, who would they be and how might they do it? And then the second question I have is dealing with Russia. Again, I was struck by what you said earlier on, which is that, you know, the Obama administration has been very quiet publicly about these attacks from Russia. With China, you know, even the FBI had like the five most wanted generals from the Chinese PLA 1638 online, you know, and we're going to go after these guys. What's the right way to dissuade Russia, assuming that actually worked with China, and maybe it didn't?
I can take a first shot, and we can see what Mike had to say on Russia. So first, on your last point, you're getting to an enormously complex question that Amy spends a lot of time on, many here at Stanford do, on cyber deterrence. And there's a lot of thinking along the lines that you don't simply deter cyber with other cyber, that you find something else that countries value. So the Sony hack's an interesting example, where Sony went after an American company, destroyed about 70% of their computing capability at Sony Entertainment Pictures, released a lot of embarrassing emails in the way that we've seen in this election. It's just those were, you know, largely about actors and actresses. They weren't largely about political figures. In the end, we turned around and put another set of small sanctions on the North Koreans that they probably have forgotten about because they've gotten so many sanctions for so many other pieces of bad behavior since, right? So that was a case where I think it's probably pretty failed deterrence, although many in the intelligence community say we haven't seen a big hack by the North Koreans since. In the Chinese case, the U.S. government was somewhat embarrassed into doing the Unit 61398 indictments because it turned out that a company, Mandiant, now FireEye, and the New York Times together ran basically a pretty conclusive case that it was them. And then they decided in the end that the way to go deal with this was indictments. So that's using the legal process, even though we know that these people will never show up in court. Finally, there's always the possibility that you would take some kind of military action in return for a cyber action. Now, trying to imagine that is a little bit difficult. I mean, I imagine if somebody, foreign power, turned off all the electric grid on the East Coast or the West Coast or whatever, that you might threaten a military response. It's hard to imagine that you would conduct a military response for messing with an election. This is sort of a classic short of war kind of activity. And so we heard a US official last week tell one of our reporters at one point, you know, if the Russians mess around, we're telling them this is an act of war. And which the answer is, come on, really? You know, think through what that means. But people are just now working out what the signaling mechanisms are for this.
So could I just say two things on the lists? I mean, that was what I was alluding to at the end of my remarks, which is to say I don't know who they would be, but I know there's a lot of actors, foreign and domestic, that would have an interest in delegitimizing this electoral process. There's a lot of disaffected people in this country. There's a lot of terrorist organizations around the world that would want to see that. So I think the imagination has now been filled in because of what's happened recently. And I even in casual conversation, I hear a lot of people talking about, if only I could do this. And so that is a big new challenge that I don't think, you know, maybe we should have been smart about it, but we haven't been thinking about it. And now we've animated a lot of people that might want to try to be the one. And then I think your point is a great one about, even if they didn't, you know, I'm the person that swung Pennsylvania. And then what do you do with that? That's a huge new other piece. On this other thing, I would just make an advertisement for Hewlett, which is to say, this is the subject matter of our time, in my view. David and I were talking about it before, which is, you know, there was a technology several decades ago, nuclear weapons, about, we had all kinds of capabilities that we didn't really have doctrinal ways to frame and think about. And this, for me, reminds me of that. And we need to do the strategy work on this. This is not, with all due respect to our Silicon Valley friends, and maybe you too, this is not a technical solution, in my view. This is, I mean, and I'm just echoing things I've heard David say just an hour ago. But I totally agree. We've got to think about it in these other ways. And for me, one analogy is the nuclear piece and the doctrinal stuff that then gets down the road of arms control and norms and in things that you do even without treaties. But there's another analogy I think it's worth thinking about, which is on the espionage side, which is to say, we all countries that have the capability practice espionage, virtual and non. In the physical spy world, I can tell you from some bitter experience as a government official, there were occasions when we had to deal with that with our Russian colleagues. And there were some informal rules of the road about how one deals with catastrophic breaches. And that may be a useful analogy to think about as well. And I will just remind you to play the metaphor out a little bit. I hope you remember. There's no reason you should remember. But in 2011, we eventually threw out 11 illegals, as we called them, right? Russian spies that were here undercover for many, many years were undercover and now has spawned this great TV show called The Americans. I highly recommend it. I want to remind you that we threw them out in 2011. That's not when we discovered them. And I would just, again, remind you that all of this stuff we're talking about is the stuff we know in public. There's a lot more I think we do not know collectively.
Yes, sir. So I want to take us back to the policy discussion we had earlier a little bit. And I think point the fact that I've worked with customers both on the private sector side and government side selling cybersecurity. And the one big gap that I see is, if you look at, it's all about why does some of the private sector companies defend themselves the way they defend themselves? Because there is a cost of a breach. There is a cost of a attack. On the government side, the challenge that I see is there's central government, there's information that stays with certain agencies, and they're protecting that. But then as you go down, the state governments, whether they're protecting the critical infrastructure, they're all doing that best effort, right? The realization of an attack on a power plant or a lake right here by poisoning something with all electronics, again, all cyber stuff, is not, like, they're aware, but they're not acting to it because of economics, budgets, everything else. So I think my question is pretty much what happened in nuclear, as you mentioned, years ago. There needs to be first policy so that you can enforce certain level of controls going across government entities and even other entities. And then comes awareness. And I'm flipping that because awareness does not drive action. I don't know if there's being thought on, and I don't know who that entity is in the government, because somebody needs to, this is not the
defense on the border. There's defense everywhere.
I will say awareness drives short-term action very well. And I think you're right to point out that on the government side, I think the stakes are much, much higher. And I think that largely because I don't, as a, you know, as a part of the economy, I don't know that you can say yet that if you're a business and you're past a certain size, that an attack against you, a successful attack against you, has a sufficient long-term economic impact. I think there are a lot of organizations that have lost credit cards and consumer data and emails of customers, presumably they promised to keep safe. All of those businesses are still operating today, might have taken a short-term hit and might have made some changes. And I feel like sometimes that distracts. You can't, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison between government and their responsibility and their duty to the American citizens and their state and local citizens and commercial entities, right? So on the commercial side, you're trying to mitigate risk and trying to address short and medium-term impact parts to your business. On the government side, I think I worry when I look at things like you know, conditions of other critical infrastructure like roads and bridges and water systems, things like that, because we haven't done a good job. We all understand bridges need to stay up and roads need to be passable, but we've kind of gotten comfortable with the fact that we can ignore them for 20 years and then come back to it later before it finally falls down. And in my estimation, we have in many cases fallen into thinking about government technology systems the same way. And I think we're discovering now very acutely that we can't manage them the same way. Fixing that from a policy perspective is probably one of the most complex things we'll address as a country. You know, to me, it's akin to the effort it took to put a person on the moon. It's going to take that kind of effort, concerted effort across commercial and public sector entities to really get us on a good track here. I'd be completely lying if I told you I knew exactly how to do that.
And let me just jump in here, because Mike alluded to this, and we're working really hard at FSI to think through this cyber deterrence piece. David, and you mentioned this, you said, oh, I probably shouldn't call that an attack. One of the problems with policy is that you have to have clear definitions. And we don't have clear definitions of cyber. The Defense Department is struggling with what's the threshold of an attack of national significance. It's really hard. Analytically, we lump all sorts of things together that don't make sense, right? Theft of your credit card information, hacking of the DNC, espionage at OPM, disabling military systems in times of war. They're all called cyber attacks, but they're very, very different things. And so part of the reason why we're struggling with the strategy piece, and I agree it has to drive the policy, the strategy has to do it, and we're not where we need to be, is that it's analytically very challenging to wrap your arms around what are we talking about, what's the threshold condition, and then what response should that engender because of this virtual space, physical reaction challenge, where the word saying, if you hit me in cyber, I'm going to hit you kinetically, don't often add up. So that's why it's so hard. And you can't just make policy and expect everybody to then fall in line, because the policy piece is really, really challenging.
Just to build on Amy's good point, if the U.S. government took the position that it was going to defend everything in the United States, you would take away all of the incentive for private companies to defend their own systems. And so when the Iranians went after Bank of America and other banks and so forth, and this went up to the NSC, and Amy and I have talked about this before, President Obama took the view, hey, you know, Bank of America and Wells Fargo and all, you know, they're big boys and girls. They're gonna have to learn how to go defend their systems. We're not gonna roll the Pentagon in to go deal with what is essentially a criminal act, perhaps sponsored by government. On the other hand, we've heard Secretary Carter say on several occasions, the U.S. government would only come in, what did he say, the top 2% of attacks where the U.S. would have. I actually think that percentage is probably high. It's probably the top 0.002%. And you know, it's that attack on the electric grid or on the cell phone network and so forth. And so Amy's right, we haven't defined this right. Espionage alone isn't it. I'm not sure that I would call the OPM hack espionage only, because you can use that data for so many other military purposes, but that's an argument, you know, worth having. And the fact that we haven't managed to have a public debate about this subject, which is, I think, a crime, has really hampered this debate. We had that in nuclear. We managed to keep everything about nuclear weapons classified, and yet still have a big debate about how we wanted to use them and how we would respond. And that ultimately came out in a very different place than it started off. And we've barely begun that in cyber.
Woman in the back who's been waiting very patiently.
Thank you. I'm Cindy Cohen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I have to admit, I experience a little bit of whiplash sometimes, because on the one hand, we have meetings like this where we talk about the tremendous insecurity of our digital networks and all of us who rely on them, whether it's for our elections, which should be of paramount importance, or all the way down. And on the other hand, I go to forums where the FBI and the NSA, to a lesser extent, but the FBI very strongly say, you know, we need to make sure people don't have access to strong encryption, which for the technical people in the room is the single best thing we can do to solve the first problem, is widely deploy the second thing. And I guess I'm wondering for the panel, how do we bridge this divide, and how much do you think the hostility of certain forces in the government to deploying the kind of strong security is playing in the fact that, say, the DNC email server apparently stored everything in the clear?
As did OPM.
So that's a whole nother panel. We should have another one of these. That would be
great. Eli's going to have a lunch for us tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. We'll do that tomorrow. I think it's, you know, I don't think, I mean, it's hard to get good encryption these days and hard to do it well. If it's not that high on your list, if cybersecurity is not that high on your list, that's why more and more people are like, listen, I can't do this myself. I need to store it someplace, like with Eric or somebody else who can encrypt it on a wholesale basis. So I think that debate has another couple of years to play out, but it's going to be key.
I think we have time for one final question. Ed.
Yes, the question that was just asked was going to be part of the second part of my question, but there's not time for anything but the first part of my question. This panel is really a panel about two separate things. One is about, we're all very anxious about early November and the weeks before early November. And so I was going to ask each of you to give us one thing that you would do or like to see done right now to relieve that anxiousness. The other question is the cultural one that was just raised. For example, when Stanford was hacked, we took big steps, and that's because we had a very sophisticated president here who understood, and a lot of people around campus didn't like it, but they all did it. And we don't take the simplest steps culturally. I got to quit saying about the culture. The first part of the question is, what would you do right now to prevent this chaos on November, or whatever it is? Oh, and David is here, so if you have a good idea, it'll end up in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Who wants to start? Bruce?
So I guess I would say that I'm not sure what you can do between now and then to prevent chaos between now and then, but on Election Day and afterwards. I think there's a lot more work to educate election officials about some basic things and get them ready to deal with potential anomalies. So that would be the thing I would like to see done.
I don't think there's any chance of preventing chaos, but I think the thing we could do is think about, you know, how do we respond to that and start having a conversation publicly about, you know, if there is chaos, what would we do? How would we consider that? And I think, in general, preparedness always takes the edge off an emergency, right? So if you're responding to something through muscle memory versus your fight or flight response, you're always going to have a better outcome.
There are four places where one could go interfere on Election Day. One is registration rolls, as we discussed, and I think preparedness to go resolve those issues and making sure people can do provisional ballots is one. The second is the actual vote. And there, I think the most important thing, I don't know if it's doable between now and Election Day, is make sure that every voting machine is tied into some kind of audit trail. And it probably can't happen between now and then. The third is in the transmission of the actual results. That's a place for the kind of data manipulation that Mike was talking about. I don't know a whole lot about how that's done because it's done differently in every state, and then it reports up to a Secretary of State in those states who has to then certify those results. But you want to watch that. And the fourth, oddly enough, is the news media reporting of all of this. Because if you actually didn't hack the vote, but you hacked the reporting, the numbers that get collected and reported out by AP, which basically all the networks and most big news organizations rely mm-hmm. on, and you had a number set there that differed dramatically from the number set of the actual countable vote, you would then have the chaos about which one is right. And of course, the actual count matters far more than the public description of it. But the public description is pretty important because people are going to say, hey, I heard on CNN that Georgia went for X, and yet the result I see is different.
Well, and it could be, especially if it happens during the day. So there's some news organizations now are going to report results during the day.
During the course of the day.
Yeah, and so this kind of thing would be quite.
Although they don't get final results. What they get is exit polls, right, which are notorious.
But no, they're going to do models, though. Yeah. They're doing models now. They're much more scientific.
So I don't have an answer before Election Day because that's just a few weeks away. But I've been beating up on the Russians. Let me say we can learn something from the Russians as well, which is to say that there are lots of countries in the world that worry about their elections being falsified, and they've developed techniques to check on that. So what you're talking about in my world is a PVT, a parallel vote tabulation, where electoral monitors physically sit there when votes are counted and then parallel tabulate the vote and using mathematical models aggregate it so that that happens in real time. Lots of countries do this in places where they're afraid that their government is stealing the vote, right? So I think we've never thought of these problems before. Maybe given, I think, just as a practical matter about our democracy, that there's so much doubt about our democratic institutions right now, that's a bigger conversation than just the election. That's not a bad thing to do anyway. And then the second piece, I also just want to maybe, because we're ending, right? We've talked about this big debate we need to have about strategy in cyber, which I think is appropriate and big. We also have to have one about democracy and hacking. I'm sorry the gentleman left because I didn't mean to be jump down his throat about WikiLeaks. But because I've been in this debate, probably I look to be a very partisan person in this debate with WikiLeaks. But I actually think it matters where you get the data from. I think it matters if it's stolen or not. I think it matters. The FBI was invoked. Well, guess what? The FBI also used SIGINT, to use the language of our day, to influence our democratic processes. Yes, Martin Luther King probably shouldn't have been having affairs. Yeah, that's okay. I can say that. But was it right for them to use SIGINT to influence the democratic process in America, just to take an extreme case to get your mind around it? I don't think it's a trivial matter that foreigners are stealing data to influence the way that we think about our democratic process. And we don't, I wanted to provoke you so that you come back, right? But this is, somehow there's this notion that this is not, it's all, well, the voters have a right to know. I want to challenge that assumption. I want to make sure that we all agree to those rules of the game, because when we're going to be litigating them, my prediction is when there's a really close election, maybe not this one, but in the future, and then somebody says, WikiLeaks, it's your scenario, but I've thought about it in the national case, but yours is actually more apropos. Somebody loses an election and then says, I lost this election because of those foreigners. That's, we need to have our kind of ethical debate about what are the rules of the game on that before that moment happens. Because there are lots of other countries that have had that. One I know well in Ukraine in 2004 led to a million people on the streets and people dying. I don't think we're there yet, but when you get to the low levels of trust in our democratic institutions that we're at now, those scenarios begin to become more real for our democracy, not just for our cyber strategy and security.
Well, we have come to the end of our time. We may not have trust in our democratic institutions, but we have trust in this panel and the illuminating information you provided. Some good news for us between now and November, a lot of sobering thought for us to think about, and more for the Hewlett Foundation to chew on to bring us all together for future conversations. Please join me in thanking our panel.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.